Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And it's my pleasure, first of all, to welcome all of you in the audience here in San Francisco, but also the online and radio audiences, and to introduce to you our speakers for tonight on the media and presidential politics, Diane Dwyer, the news anchor for NBC here in the Bay Area that I'm sure all of you know, and Randy Shandabill, a former news anchor and political interviewer, and now in charge of Shandabill Communications, and he promises to say why he made that switch. Diane.
Okay, thank you so much for having both of us. It's very nice to be back, and it's nice to be working with Randy again. We worked together at KTVU for about 10 or 12 years.
A long time ago.
Yeah, it was a while back. I jumped ship for NBC, and then Randy's jumped ship altogether, so there you go. The most interesting part of this discussion is always you guys and your questions, so we will get to that very quickly and not bore you too much with what we have to say and find out what you're interested in as well. But it is always fun and engaging to find out where you are, and you're an incredibly informed audience, so we will do our best to keep up with these guys along the way as well. So right now, just to get started, the candidates are going to spend, as I read it today, a little over $1 billion on TV ads during this campaign. That is a lot of money. And as George said, money is influence. It buys influence, or at least it buys time, right? And for what? It's to sway the 5% of the undecided vote. So is there anyone here who's still undecided? One? We have one. We're all looking for you. And so are the candidates.
and just to note really quick, when Diane says the 5% who are the undecided vote, it's not the undecideds in California.
Right.
It's, as we all know, the swing states. And when you hear people talk about the swing states, the undecided states, they're not even talking about those states. They're talking about the very few people who are undecided in those very few states. So that $1 billion-plus dollars you're talking about is really directed at a very small slice of the pie.
Imagine if those folks could just get that money and say, you know, that would be pretty interesting. Okay, so on that note, let's get right to it. So these campaigns are spending all this money, right? And they're running these ads, but we're not seeing them because they're not running them here in California. They're running them in the battleground states. So I thought we'd start with just a look at two of those campaigns, those ads, so that we could get a feel for what these states are seeing. So let me pop up here real quickly, and I'll bring up this one. So for the first one I'm going to start with is a Mitt Romney ad that just started this week. He started a $5 million campaign ad buy in the battleground states. This is one for Wisconsin.
The Janesville, Wisconsin General Motors plant. A simple promise, simply broken.
But I also know how much progress you've made, how many hybrids and fuel-efficient vehicles you're churning out, and I believe that if our government is there to support you and give you the assistance you need to retool and make this transition, that this plant will be here for another 100 years.
At that moment, a simple promise was made. In October 2008, when it was clear the plant would close, he said, "As president, I will lead an effort to retool plants like the GM facility in Janesville." A promise made a second time. The simple facts: promises made on the campaign trail, promises broken in Washington. Just ask the people of Janesville, Wisconsin.
Okay. So, pretty compelling. Any idea, anyone have a guess on one little fact that was left out? Yes. It closed 2 months before President Obama was inaugurated as president. So it's...
I think they announced the closing, but part of it was still operating after he was inaugurated.
So if that's true, I didn't know that. What I read is that the whole thing closed down, or the decision to close it down was certainly made before Obama became president. Whether it's right or wrong, there's some misleading information in there, right? And the question is, are the folks in Wisconsin, are the TV folks, are the newspapers looking into that kind of... those types of questions, but with this much buy, it's hard to separate out the misleading. You know, misleading is different than lying, right? And there's that gray line in there. Were you going to pop in there?
Well, if I could just interject for a second, you don't see it as much on television or in the newspapers as 4-8 years ago. But do you remember all the ad watch things that local TV would do? And that got really very difficult to do because there are so many ads in so many different states that it's really time-consuming. And by the time you would analyze and track the history and build up a piece to do that, there'd be new ads and you would be out of date. And I don't think that the ad watches, even when they would catch candidates on misleading information, most of the time it didn't make much difference. Example, I guess the biggest example would be the Swift boat ads of John Kerry. Mm-hmm. You know, most people knew that those were a distortion at best, and most every major news entity pointed that out, but those ads obviously worked.
Absolutely. All right, let's watch this one. This is an Obama ad that ran it started about a month ago.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Was there ever any year when you paid lower than the 13.9%?
I haven't calculated that. I'm happy to go back and look.
Did Romney pay 10% in taxes, 5%, zero? We don't know. But we do know that Romney personally approved over $70 million in fictional losses to the IRS as part of the notorious Son of Boss tax scandal, one of the largest tax avoidance schemes in history. Isn't it time for Romney to come clean?
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
And did you hear his joke at the convention where he talked about that? I'm sure you've all heard, I'm a Barack Obama, and I've approved. I'm like, no, we haven't actually heard that because we haven't had those ads there. So that one... It leaves the impression that Romney might have paid 0% in taxes, right? So we don't know, but it certainly gave you the impression that that was a possibility and that he's to blame for one of the largest tax avoidance schemes in history. It was Romney's client, Marriott, and tons of other taxpayers who were part of that scheme. So again, it's, you know, not entirely wrong, but entirely misleading along the way. And with $1 billion to spend, we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in those small markets to get to how many people? I don't know, 5 or 6 people in each state who are going to decide who's the next president. Anyway, so we've got that. We've got that misleading thing going on. So advertising, I would argue, just by its nature and its power in numbers and dollars, has some influence over the elections. And it isn't something particularly to media or to journalists, although is our job to go through those advertisements and tell you what's factual or not is a question that is, I think, pretty relevant to media today. Anyway, the second part, so that was one, advertising. And then two would be, you know, why does television wield power or does it? And you can go back to Nixon and Kennedy, right, and how that made a difference. And TV personality, you have, the charisma?
Yeah, well...
Go for it.
Let me just go for a second here. First of all, before I talk about my little theories here, which will be gross generalizations, and I'm sure you'll be able to pick them apart and feel free to do so, how many here feel that there is media bias that affects presidential elections? Okay. How many people here feel that the media bias is generally a liberal bias that affects the elections? And how many people feel there's a conservative bias that... okay, well, it's kind of split, but there does seem to be a consensus that there is a media bias and that the bias affects presidential elections. And my own personal theory is that I disagree with that. I think that, yes, there is media...
You disagree with the whole audience.
Yes, I do. I disagree with the notion that the media bias affects the election. There is media bias. And obviously the media has an effect on presidential elections. But if you track history since when TV became important, that doesn't appear to be the main factor in deciding who wins and who loses. Before I go on, let me just tell you really quickly, quick segue. I was the political editor at KTVU for decades. And one of the reasons I left was in part what we're talking about, a growing frustration of the role of media and how limited the role of media, local media in particular, was becoming in political discourse and how it was getting more and more difficult to do my job and feel proud of my work. So I've gone to the dark side.
Can I throw one thing in there on that note, though, just real quickly, as far as sort of that the challenges of being a reporter in this market with politicians, whether it's presidential or local, is that whole concept. One of the things I was going to we'll talk about is the influence we have over politicians or the press, but then the vice versa, right? Politicians grant us access, and so if we're too tough, we lose access. And so there's a real, you know, give and take between politicians and reporters, and what's our role? Our role is not to get the next interview. Our role is to do the best we can on the interview we have. But it's become more and more challenging because they have the power over access, and we need access to those politicians, and we've talked
so
about
that,
it.
That's more so now than it used to be.
It's worse.
I think it's getting worse.
But, I mean, I've been blacklisted by the governor and by the U.S. Attorney General, which is sort of a badge of honor because I was asking real questions, but which is good, I guess, for me, but not so good as far as asking, you know, I didn't get to ask the next round of questions.
I was blacklisted by President Bush.
Good for you.
Anyway, getting back to objectivity and bias, back when I was reporting, I had to ask my – of course, I – first confession, I'm a Democrat. I'm probably centrist liberal Democrat. But as a reporter, I tried to be objective. But by whose standards am I objective? By San Francisco standards? By California standards? A little bit more liberal than the rest of the country, but conservative by San Francisco standards, or by national standards? I kind of opted to try to be objective by California standards. But anyway, the point is, it's difficult. What is objective? And, you know, I used to get criticism, nasty emails on both sides. Anyway, the point I'm making is, for those who think that there is a liberal bias and that it's affected presidential elections, let's go back to January 1961. If you count how many years, who's held office? Since then, when TV became important, Democrats have been in the White House for 24 years, Republicans 28 years. Want to make it a little bit more modern because more people think that the media has become more liberal in recent times. Since 1981, Democrats 31 years? Yes, 32 years by January. Democrats have been in the White House 12 years, Republicans in office for 20 years. So if there is a liberal media bias in presidential politics, at least looking at those results, it doesn't appear to have helped Democratic candidates. Also, my personal theory is that based on presidential elections going all the way back since 1960, you could almost always, with a reasonable degree of accuracy, predict who's going to win once you know who the general election nominees are. And regardless of how the media covers the race. First, unless things are going just terribly, terribly wrong, most presidents are reelected. In fact, since 1986, 116 years ago, only one president was voted out of office after taking the presidency from the other party 4 years before. Think about that, okay? So, and that one time was 1980 when Reagan beat Carter, who came in after Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. And obviously, the Carter presidency was troubled, and obviously, Ronald Reagan was a very strong candidate. Now, some people say, well, what about George H.W. Bush? He succeeded a president from his own party. So I'm talking about when someone takes over for the other party. So looking at this situation, based upon going back over 116 years, you would say that Barack Obama seems to have a leg up, okay? And then the other thing about the Jimmy Carter comparison, I don't think Jimmy Carter is or was as strong a candidate as Barack Obama is. He's certainly not as charismatic or likable. And Mitt Romney certainly is not Ronald Reagan. I think even Mitt Romney would acknowledge that. Do you want to go in, or should I continue here?
I'll pop in a second.
Okay. let me quickly segue to my charisma theory, and you've all heard this before, but let's take a look at who's won presidential elections and why, and then you tell me after I talk about this how much difference the media made, other than giving candidates a lot of exposure. Obviously, that matters. You have to give candidates exposure to make a difference, but you tell me whether it was the commentary that made a difference or whether something else made a difference. Let's go back, working backwards. 2008, Obama versus McCain. Both very intelligent guys. Obama center-left, McCain center-right. Obama handsome, articulate, and charismatic. McCain older, a little bit stiff and awkward, though obviously very intelligent also. 2004, Bush versus Kerry. On intelligence and grasp of issues, a lot of people thought that Kerry had it over George W. Bush. But Bush, as clunky as his speeches often were, had a bit more charm than did Kerry. Anyone remember that joke? John Kerry walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Why the long face?" sorry, couldn't resist. 2000, Bush versus Gore. Again, on intelligence and grasp of issues, most analysts, most reporters, seemed to hint that they thought Gore had it over Bush. But Bush was the guy you wanted to have a beer with. Remember the talk about which candidate would you want to have a beer with? The beer factor, charming, folksy. He had a sense of humor compared to Gore, who came across as stiff and arrogant. And having interviewed both of them many times, he was stiff and arrogant. Clinton versus Dole. On charisma, likability, no comparison, right? Clinton versus George H.W. Bush. I'm going back, 1992 now, 4 years at a time. Clearly, the economy was sinking at just the wrong time for George H.W. Bush. And if you remember, Ross Perot siphoned off some Republican votes. And it didn't help, but mainly it didn't help that he was running against one of the most charismatic politicians of modern times. So are you beginning to see a pattern here? I'll go back. 1988, George H.W. Bush versus Dukakis. Kind of a draw here. Two bright guys, both of them a bit stiff. But remember the picture of Michael Dukakis wearing a helmet in the military tank? Okay. And remember his cold, unlikable, insensitive answer to a debate question? It was from Bernard Shaw. I think it was the first debate, and it was the first question in the first debate. Bernard Shaw, former CNN anchor, asked, Mr. Dukakis, if Kitty Dukakis was raped and murdered, would you support the death penalty? Dukakis was against the death penalty, and so he was asked this theoretical question: if his own loved one was killed and raped, would he support it under those circumstances? His answer was, no, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know I've opposed the death penalty for all my life. He didn't express any emotion. He seemed cold, dry, and there was so much talk about how his answer, while he defended his position on being against the death penalty, seemed cold and insensitive and robotic and weird. And it really cost him. Things like that matter. I'm almost done here.
Okay.
84, Reagan Mondale. Mondale came across as really charming in person, but on camera, there's no comparison to Reagan. Reagan Carter, I don't have to talk about that. Carter versus Gerald Ford. There are very few politicians who could make Jimmy Carter seem funny, charming, and charismatic. Gerald Ford was one of those few. 1972, Nixon versus McGovern. No one ever accused Nixon of being especially likable, but he certainly was a more dynamic speaker than McGovern. And, of course, McGovern had that whole episode with his running mate, who it turns out had shock therapy, and there was a whole fiasco. It was obviously a disaster. The only outlier to the charisma theory is Nixon versus Humphrey in 1968. Humphrey was to many kind of a bigger-than-life politician, but he was LBJ's vice president, and he was saddled with the unpopular Vietnam War, and the Democratic Party in 1968 wasn't even unified. The convention was split. Remember, that was the year McCarthy was running. Robert F. Kennedy seemed positioned to win the nomination before he was assassinated. There were the riots at the convention. And so Humphrey, even though he perhaps came across as more likable and charismatic than Richard Nixon, he was doomed before that election really started. LBJ Goldwater in 1964, it wouldn't have mattered. This was just a year after the assassination. There was a sympathy vote going on. And, of course, the defining birth of TV's importance, 1960, Kennedy versus Nixon. I don't need to say anything about that. But let me just tell you why, because I know it seems silly and superficial that I'm talking about charisma and likability, but let me tell you why it's important. If you have charisma, if you're likable, people listen to you. They pay attention to your speech. And when they pay attention to your speech, maybe they will hear what you're actually saying. If you're boring, and people aren't necessarily warm and fuzzy about you, they're not going to hear and be open to what you're saying. And again, this is why I think when push comes to shove, despite the economy, that Obama going into November looking ahead has an advantage over Romney. You could also just go to the conventions just a week ago. The audience numbers for Obama and for Michelle Obama were much higher than for Mitt Romney and for Ann Romney. And again, what that means, if you look at those two speeches, a lot of what Mitt Romney said made sense. It was good. But it was kind of stiff. It wasn't particularly compelling. And you may have fallen asleep or drifted off when he was saying it.
But it is frustrating in the sense of that it does matter so much how you say what you say versus what you're actually saying.
I acknowledge it's a shame.
You know,
it's a darn shame, but it is.
It's reality. And my small example of it was in 94 and 95, Clinton and Gore both came here together for some event in Silicon Valley. And I was at the press conference when they arrived, and Clinton came up, and I had two questions with him. It was in a crowded press room. There were lots of people there. And for those two questions, we were in a room, just the two of us. It was Bill and it was Di, and we were together. And we had this moment, you know. And what was interesting is not only did that moment occur in person, but what he does so well, Clinton, is he gets through that camera, right? And he goes right into your living room and does it to you at home. He connects to you at that level. An hour later, I had a one-on-one interview with Al Gore. Sit down, intimate, besides a couple cameras, you know, much different setting. Thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to have this great experience with this person. And nothing. And half an hour of nothing. Here I had, you know, 45 seconds or whatever it was of something with Bill Clinton, and Al Gore couldn't get through to me one-on-one and absolutely could not get through that camera. And one in-between example was Janet Reno, who I interviewed when she was Attorney General here, talking about the death penalty. And she was incredibly dynamic in person. We had a moment, too, during our interview, and I thought, I came back and I told our producer, Mike Kelly, I said, I am going to show a different side of Janet Reno. This is a whole, and I pop in the tape, and there is the awkward, funky, weird Janet Reno on screen. And so, you know, there's the connecting in person, and then there's that connecting through the camera that matters so much, because these politicians can't go shake hands with everybody, right? So this is how they get through.
This leads into something that I wanted to say. Obviously, the candidates and their campaign managers and their consultants are very much aware, again, that the likability, charisma factor is disproportionately important, and they campaign with that in mind. And one of the ways they do that is when they come to places like California or other states and do interviews. When I was interviewing presidential candidates, typically what they would do is they would do round robins. They would do 5-10 minutes with each of the network affiliates. And I thought, boy, this is kind of stupid. As a reporter who wants to get in depth, I would rather that they do a California issues only press conference where we all came and we had 40 minutes at them. Okay. But they knew, playing to reporters' egos and vanity and wanting the shot of appearing with, oh, I'm with the president or I'm with George W. Bush or whatever, that they would get more airtime and be able to seem more personal in a one-on-one context. And so, one, I tried to get other reporters locally to agree to demand that they would do that. Well, actually, at the time I did, all but one agreed, and I won't name who that is because I happen to like the guy, but he wouldn't agree to that. And two, the candidates probably wouldn't have agreed anyway. But the point is, this is how that works to their advantage. Rather than having 30 minutes, 40 minutes, where everyone's asking him questions and follow-up questions and going in-depth and perhaps getting him to go beyond their talking points, they know that if they have 5-10 minutes that are repeated 4 times, and sometimes you'll literally have crews in 4 different corners of the room and the candidate will just rotate the room, they know that they're going to essentially get the same questions from everybody. Because there's always some news of the day that you have to ask, and you have to ask the essential questions, and so they're better prepared. They're at less risk for being taken off message, and they could be charming and interactive. And this is especially clever, and the one who really mastered it more than anyone was Bill Clinton. He would even, not me, I swear it, trust me, I didn't do this, but some reporters who would who are particularly vain, and this gets to the shallowness of TV news, would tape their name on the bottom of their shoe and hold their shoe up so that the candidate can see their name on the bottom of their shoe, right? Okay.
Okay, I've never heard that.
Well, I heard this. I should give credit. Chris Lahane, a local Democratic consultant, used to work in the Clinton White House, and he told me these stories. He told me I'm free to share this story. A lot of reporters would, a lot of politicians would repeat my name over and over again, like that's going to work. Well, Randy. Bill Clinton would only use the reporter's name once. He would only use it once, and that would be connected to the soundbite that he wanted to make sure was on the air that night. So if the reporter asked him a question he didn't want to get to, or the reporter asked him a question that he didn't think would help his polling numbers, he wouldn't use the reporter's name. But when he was in his wheelhouse, well, Randy, so again, it's all very clever.
As far as the influence, getting back to the influence for a second, and we should open it up for questions pretty soon. But one of the things I understand from your research that there's not the influence as far as if the media is biased left, as far as the results. But I do think there's an influence on media focusing on issues. So the media has some influence over what issues are going to be discussed, perhaps not how people feel about the issues, but some discussion over what those issues are and focusing on what those issues are, whether it's, non-issues, as in Clint Eastwood talking to a chair that became a big story. And what's changing, I think, drastically now and in the last, say, 4 years is the internet and social media. Because for the first time, people are driving that conversation too. So in some ways, journalists are losing some of that power because that power is coming from the democracy, which is sort of a concept. But in that sense, that's very exciting. I think the internet change and that fact that there is some movement percolating up instead of pushing those messages down. And for the first time, it's a two-way conversation to some degree going on in that. And we get pushed through the media on a really simple local level. That poor boy, Brett Olson, who was missing from Lafayette, who was up in San Luis Obispo, his friends and people drove that media coverage. They got 100,000 people following them on Facebook. They got on, the Giants' big screen during the Dodgers game because they drove it and they made that happen. And that power to the sort of the people making caring about what they hasn't happened before at this level, I don't think, which I think is great. On the other hand, Google and social media has changed it up because, say, depending on what I search, as you know, on Google, Google gets to know me, right? And so then I go and I search Obama, and I'm going to get different results than you get if you search Obama, than somebody else is going to get. And that is scary because the common experience that we normally get from television, from watching 9/11 on television, from watching it, that, we don't get that anymore in the internet because we're getting pushed to what our beliefs are. And that's, I think, sort of dangerous and a little bit scary.
Well, it's not even that you're getting pushed to what your beliefs are. It's that you're drilling down into what your beliefs are. In other words, for those who bemoan the state of journalism these days, in some ways, I agree, but in some ways, journalism is actually better than ever. You have access to more information than ever. Yep. You could find out more about a political candidate than ever. You could find out more about, a spill in the Gulf than ever. You could find out more about anything you want to than ever. You have the capability of drilling down. What's missing, and what I think is particularly troubling, or at least different, is that back when I was young, I hate to say
way back how, when.
Yeah, way back when. Way back when. And you read a newspaper or watched TV news, you were at least inadvertently exposed to all kinds of things. And you had more shared experience. I would read the whole paper. I wouldn't read every article in total, but I'd see a headline and I'd at least read the first sentence or two to decide if it was worth my time and then move on to what interested me. And so most people were exposed to more things. Now I think what's happening is people are learning more about what they care about and less about you know, the rest of the world. And I don't know exactly how that's going to play out, what that's going to mean. But I think if you think about it, I mean, even at the level of, you know, you go to a cocktail party, you used to be able to talk about anything that was going on with anybody there because everyone knew everything that was going on, at least a little bit. Now everyone's in their own little world. One person there, you know, holding the wine is into, you know, energy. The person holding the vodka is all about Obama or, you know, whatever. Everyone drills down into their own little world of news. So,
where you can get more information, as you said,
and
more content, but the vetting of that content. It's harder to find good content on the internet, at least when you're reading the New York Times. It's been vetted to some degree. There are mistakes, but it's been vetted, and so there's some credibility there that we don't have on the internet all the time. The other thing that I wanted to just pop back to real fast is the power of the media, and one of the things that I think is dangerous with that, and perhaps social media could change this a little bit, is there is power in who we pay attention to and who we give time to. And so that means third-party candidates just have never really had a chance in this democracy to really make a difference because somewhere along the line the press has decided that it's not that they're not viable, and we only have so much time, and so we give that time to the viable candidates. And that is a disservice, I think, to democracy. And I think perhaps social media may be a place where that could change, which could be a very good thing. I mean, social media is a great thing. It just depends how it's used along the way. But my final note is, as far as media and being unbiased, one of, I think, my biggest concerns with it is this concept of journalists that in order to be unbiased, you have to tell both sides of the story. And yes, you need to tell both sides of the story. But if one side of the story is lying, you can say that one side of the story is lying, and it's always gray. It's not black and white. But my joke is, you know, they throw it out to me, and I say, yes, you know, the Republicans say the building's still standing, and the Democrats say it's collapsed. Back to you. And there's an option for me to walk outside and see whether it's standing or collapsed. And I can tell that and tell the truth and not be unbiased. That is, not be biased. That's an unbiased point of view. And journalists, some journalists, I think, have lost that concept because they're so afraid of getting caught up in the bias factor. And it's challenging. And there are certain issues in particular that are exceptionally challenging on that. But revealing lies or untruths, that isn't being unbiased. And if there's anything I'd like to see change, that's what I'd like to see change, where we can start telling what's actually true without appearing that we're biased in one way or another.
Let me, before we open up the questions, just go back to...
Thank you.
Let me just go back to the conventions, since they just happened, and the quote-unquote likability factor. If you watch the conventions, did you notice that every major candidate started his or her speech with 5 minutes about how much they love their spouse and about their kids and about, boy, when they were young, they suffered through hard times? Okay. Now, why are they doing that? The first 5 minutes of every speech is about making themselves seem approachable, likable, someone you'd want to hang out with. Okay. So candidates are aware of this. Again, it seems silly. It seems artificial. But it matters. Just look at going back. And this affects who television and print, but more so television, gives coverage to. Again, if there is a media bias, other than, of course, Fox has a conservative bias and MSNBC has a liberal bias, they wear those biases on their sleeve, I would say that generally at the organizational level, the bias in media organizations is a bias towards ratings and profit.
Money.
Okay? And interesting candidates, lively candidates, as opposed to boring candidates who don't speak well, are better TV. And so you're going to give them more coverage. I mean, it's this kind of reinforcing circle, a whirlpool of bad news. And that's kind of what happens.
Yep. So. Profit and ratings as opposed to sort of public television concept. Okay, should we open it up to questions? It's about that time. How do we do this, George?
Well, first, I want to thank you for a great introduction to the topic. That was excellent. And I'll go around with the mic for those of you who want to ask. Please just raise your hand. And if you want to get in line, that might make you give you a little bit better edge. So go ahead here.
Thank you to the great panelists. I just wanted to question what you said at the beginning, that 5%, that all the political ads are aimed at 5% of undecided voters, because I'm just kind of concerned that constantly being slammed with jargon-heavy advertisements, that there are a lot of people who are who may be susceptible to following the jargon, and it seems that the Republicans have steadily blamed Obama for problems that they first caused and then obstructed from solving. And my question is...
What's your slant on that? No, I'm just kidding.
My question is, you mentioned, for instance, that Fox does have a conservative bias that they wear on their sleeve. I'm very concerned that immediately before the election is the great American pastime, the World Series, which is going to be broadcast, I think, unfortunately, on Fox this year. And I'm wondering whether you think there will be any nefarious effect of Fox having the rights to broadcast these games and what they might say in between innings.
Well, why don't I take that? I don't think there will be a problem. I can't guarantee it. But the station I used to work for, Channel 2, was a Fox affiliate, okay? And that didn't mean we were associated with the Fox News Network. That meant that we were kind of connected to Fox Broadcasting, Simpsons, American Idol, cartoons, you know, that kind of stuff, not necessarily the news network. Nonetheless, there were people who thought that we were conservative, and we weren't. And I could tell you that in my long time working there, I was never told what to cover, how to cover it. I was told to keep my story short. I was told, gee, they have to be entertaining. But I wasn't told that they have to have a liberal slant, a conservative slant, or anything of the above. And I would think, if anything, even Fox, on the eve of an election, and I think they will, there is a firewall between their broadcasting network and the news network. If anything, they would be deferential to the sitting president, I would think.
And it's sports. Those folks aren't really connected to the Fox News section of it either to that degree. So I wouldn't be that concerned. If things to be concerned about, it wouldn't be on the top of my list.
Having said that, most professional athletes do tend to be Republican. The reason? They're wealthy. And they're concerned about tax issues and how much of their money is going to be, quote unquote, taken away.
Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for the program tonight. You said something earlier about being 86th several times when you're talking to candidates. They wouldn't give you the time of day. I wondered if maybe sometimes it might not be worth running the risk of being 86th. For instance, with Obama, with his background, where he grew up and things, if you saw the movie 2016, Obama's America, that's in the theaters now, it raises a lot of questions about it. Another thing that raises questions is this ticky-tacky thing about Romney and how many years' tax returns did he do. I think it would be more interesting to find out where Obama's money came from. Admittedly, he grew up poor, but all of a sudden he's wealthy. The people that gave him this money, what kind of a hold do they have on him? I think that would be very interesting.
Well, following the money trail with any candidate is always interesting, right? At the congressional level, the state level, it's always interesting to see what lobbyists are involved and what decisions they're making for law. And I think Randy and I both pointed out that neither one of us are afraid of being 86th. The problem is once you're 86th, you no longer have access to that person. And so you have one shot to ask those questions and you can't get back and continue to ask questions, which is just sort of appalling on a bunch of different levels as far as that's concerned. But as far as following money trails, following the money is always interesting. I think we do it as best we can on a pretty regular basis, and I think you did along the way for many years.
I did, yes.
Yeah, and those are relevant stories that are absolutely worth investigating, no matter whether it's a Democrat, Republican, or a lobbyist or whatever it is.
Yes. Let me see if I can get this up to my height. Thank you for the comment on lobbyists. I'm actually heartened to see the turnout for questions tonight because we do appreciate not only the chances you get to spend intimate time with the candidates, but the chances we get to spend intimate time with you. So thank you for your time this evening. I did want to ask, I'm sure other people will bring up the super PAC issues and all the additional sources of advertising that we're getting now that are nominally unaffiliated with the candidate. What I wanted to ask you about, whether you'd experienced more, is one of the terms that the political think tanks in Washington and otherwise have been spinning out very heavily over the past decade or so, which is the entirety of my political experience of the United States, is what they call the Overton window, where you're able to shift the public debate by continuous repetition of a single topic, whether it's true or not, and otherwise moving the goalposts of what it is considered legitimate to talk about, whether that's through ignoring an issue continuously or continuously bringing something up that may be of questionable validity, as I'm sure people have many experiences and examples, and whether you've seen that sort of unwillingness to address certain topics become more a matter of party platforms or the things that you've experienced in attempting to move stories.
Unwillingness to address? Are you talking about the candidates themselves?
The candidates, the parties, their media minders, quote unquote. In other words, just attempting to, I can only think of a German phrase, essentially to silence something by totally being mum on the topic.
Well, there are many ways to silence questions you don't like.
You don't answer it by...
Well, you don't answer. That's not a good way. And I don't know that I could answer your question directly. That's a tough one. But I can tell you, just in everyday discourse, there are ways candidates can dictate what questions they are going to answer without seeming evasive. I am one of the few consultants who actually encourage my clients to answer questions, even if it's only a short answer. You know, I think people get insulted when people don't answer questions. For example, you're out on a first date and the person you're on a date with says, "So, have you ever been married?" And your answer is, "What about those Niners?" I think the person on the other side of the table would get irritated with you. So I think there is an advantage to actually answering the question. But you can be more animated answering the questions you want to answer. You could say the reporter's name, a la Bill Clinton, when you want to answer a question. You could use analogies that are very colorful when you want the question, when you want the answer used rather than another answer. But as for topics, I'm worried because there are fewer news organizations that have political specialists who have the perseverance to push back against the handlers who try to limit the questioning. I do think that experience matters, and I do think, for example, at my station, there are certainly people doing politics there, but they're kind of doing politics on a rotating basis, and it's hard to really know the background of issues and know when someone's BSing you, excuse my terminology. And that matters, and I'm concerned about that.
I think that works well. I have the same concerns, and it is, if you're not on it all the time, it's harder to ask the questions because you just don't know it. You know, most reporters are general assignments, so one day they're out covering crime, the next day it's politics, the next day it's something else, and you just can't possibly go as in-depth or understand it at the same level when you're covering so many different topics as opposed to a political reporter who spends all their time doing just that. Yes?
Hi there. I'm a little more cynical in my opinion of the media. What I've noticed, as Randy pointed out, there, I used your name, so you have to talk about me.
We'll use that soundbite.
Yeah, exactly.
the objectivity has been sacrificed upon the altar of neutrality for the last, 15 years? And Fox, I beg to differ, does not wear their orientation on their sleeves. Their slogan, "We report, you decide," kind of pretends that they're objective media. But your point about the media being a profit-making organization, not wanting to offend the audience, leads to, some say, journalism, where each side of the argument has to be presented and objectivity is lost. It's a crying shame.
Well, you're absolutely right.
And that was my point on the building standing and the buildings collapsed, you know, that that's not being objective.
And with politics, the shadings are so much more complicated.
Exactly.
I mean, you can't walk outside and
but you can do more. You can do more.
You get to something. One of the main reasons, and again, I do not say this as a criticism of my former employer. They were very good to me for a number of decades. I think they are still amongst the best local broadcast organizations in the country, though not as good as they once were.
Right after but, NBC? No, I'm just joking.
Anyway, for the longest time, they'd let me go three and a half, four minutes long on the nightly news. And the reason that's important in covering politics is different than covering a crime or the weather. In a crime or the weather, you go, you talk to the police, they tell you who they're looking for, what the crime was, and you talk to witnesses or neighbors, and you do the kind of obvious story, the hits, runs, and airs of the story. In politics, it's often what makes the story what someone isn't saying. And why aren't they saying that? And why are they saying that in a certain way? And what are they really getting at? And that kind of analysis you can't do in a minute and a half, and that's what was being required and is being required of most television news stations now, news reporters. And it was just getting harder and harder to do a job that I felt did a service to viewers. And fortunately, I had been there long enough that I felt okay leaving. But again, let me emphasize, I still like you, KTVU. Okay.
Bring back Dennis and Elaine.
About a week ago, Obama went on Reddit for about 30 minutes, and he did an AMA, which stands for Ask Me Anything. So this is a forum where there was no media in the middle. There were no handlers. It was so popular that the servers crashed, and for most of the time he couldn't answer because the servers were down. But he did get in about 10 replies. My question is, in a world where media is so consumed with ratings and with money, and they're so spineless to the point that even though fact-checkers say that it's not a gray area, that certain things are actual lies, but the media won't say that they're lies because they're afraid of telling the truth, when is it going to get to a point where media is taken out of the equation and they are no longer relevant to the conversation?
Well, hopefully not anytime soon.
well, maybe after you retire.
My job. He's done. no, I do think that social media, certainly it showed up 4 years ago with the election 4 years ago where the president, in particular Obama, went around the press a lot and went straight to his Facebook page and that kind of stuff to get his message out and skipped us, the middleman, which in some ways is, like I said, it's a good thing in the sense of if there can be a two-way conversation there that hasn't been there before. On the other hand, it also can be incredibly manipulative.
Yeah, it's not really a two-way conversation in the way that Obama used it. He knows that reporters who want access and aren't getting access are going to be left with no option other than reporting what he's doing through social
right.
media.
Well,
and in
this,
social media, without
control.
The reporters there, he has control over which answers he answers.
In the case of Facebook, perhaps, but believe me, he can't control Redditors. No way.
No, but he can ignore some questions and answer others. And there won't be reporters yelling with cameras rolling, why won't you answer that question?
I just wish media would be have a little more chutzpah in the equation.
Well, I do too.
I also want to talk about the media. Number one, you said the media is not biased. If it wasn't biased, it would not have reported for a month about the book that was written about John Kerry. The media talked about it for the entire election time, about the book. That book should have gone to a trash. It was nothing. It was completely a lie, and the media should not have talked about it. It should not have been published in the first place. Anyway, number two, I hear Rush Limbaugh in the news, but I never heard about Jim Hightower. Anybody knows about Jim Hightower? You know, we don't hear about him. Yeah, see? So that's one thing biased and one thing to the right. Number three, why should news be in the profit? News is just news. Read it. And then the other shows should be maybe for profit or something, but the news should be just news, like the BBC. You just read it.
Well, the BBC is a very interesting, I mean, we have public television here, but having it at the level of the BBC may be the answer. It may be that we have to take profit out of news in order to get back to not thinking about the ratings. Is my station going to kill me on that
yeah,
one? I'm not sure.
A little cold dose of reality ain't going to happen, ain't going to happen, ain't going to happen.
But
first of all, it's not going to happen because, again, I believe most reporters are either centrist or liberal. Okay? If you think about the definition of what makes a reporter a good reporter, what do you have to be a good reporter? Well, the first thing is a voracious curiosity. You have to be hungering for something new every day. I mean, it doesn't kind of fit into the mold of what makes a conservative. In general, of course, there are exceptions. And I think Diane's ready to disagree with me a little bit. But I do think that most studies show that most reporters are liberal and they try to set aside their bias, much like a judge would try to set aside his or her bias. And knowing, or at least sensing, that most reporters are liberal. I mean, you already have in Congress, they want to cut funding to NPR. And part of it is because of the perceived bias there. So that there's going to be public networks and public print and that's going to make the difference and take over. Could happen someday, not soon.
I'm with you, not soon, but I think it's a reasonable thing to be asking the question and trying to figure out if there's another platform out there to give news that doesn't have that same pressure, because there's a lot of pressure. I mean, the ratings, there's no question the ratings are pressure. They're the way the station makes money and pays the bills, and that's important. And once you – there isn't pressure. We don't sit in news meetings and discuss how can we – you know, how should we tell the story to increase ratings? I mean, we're not at that level, but there's this – but you know what the ratings are every day. We get them overnight. It used to be you only got them during the ratings months. Now you get them immediately. Not only overnight, you get them second by second.
Actually, so, I disagree. There is pressure on how to tell the story to boost ratings. For example, why do you think – I mean, not on the slant you should have, but how you should tell the story. For example, how many political stories, at least at the local level, do you see where half the story is MOS, man on the street, on what – he
but that's
or
not
she
compelling.
Thinks.
But I would argue that's not compelling.
But that's what consultants think is compelling. And that's what they're telling you to do. And again, I agree. It's not
off.
Compelling.
Yeah.
It's not compelling. But they think that that's more interesting because it breaks up, oh, that's just some old white guy talking political jargon and everyone knows he's a liar. I don't want to hear it anymore. Let's go to the man on the street. And they think that that's more interesting. And half the time, I would go out asking people to comment on an issue they hadn't heard about yet. And how and why is that more informative than hearing, let me use that 30 seconds to hear more from the candidates.
Right. But okay? I still would argue it doesn't help with the ratings. I don't think those stories do help. I mean, the MOS's man on the street interviews don't help with the ratings. So perhaps we're digging our own grave. I don't know.
I would agree they don't help with the ratings, but the consultants seem to think they do.
Go ahead.
Industry acronyms coming out here. So this is an unpopular take, and maybe, Randy, you'll speak to it more than Diane for your position. But how much would you put on the American public for driving part of this? So, you know, whether it's, you know, politics or media for sale, you know, the length of a story, like you said, needs to be a minute and a half, and it's on a timeline because they got to move to the next thing. Or they got to get the, you know, what, you know, Brad and Angelina did on in that 30-minute time frame. How much would you put on the American public not being able to handle 3-4 minutes on one story anymore? If you watch the BBC, obviously it's very in-depth. PBS, you're going to get different layers of each story. You don't get anything from watching the nightly news, let alone local news, on a story. You get a little bit, but it doesn't get into the actual, you know,
I want to pop in one quick thing before Randy starts, is just that that concept of the shorter stories does come from consultants. Consultants tell us that people don't have the attention span. And I've always argued that I don't know what's going on in the rest of the country, but in the Bay Area, they do have that attention span. But a good example that I always use is 60 Minutes. Those are three stories. They're, you know, 15 minutes each. And it has been the top-rated news program for 30 or 40 years. And so apparently people do have the attention span to listen longer and go deeper. And perhaps the ratings loss has been because we've been making it shorter and less, you know, with less content. And that's why people have tuned away from us, as opposed to the other way around, that people don't have the attention span. NBC is changing things up, which is interesting right now. I just did a story on United Airlines and they lost a child in Chicago. That was a local, a family in San Francisco. The story ran 5.5 minutes in a half an hour newscast. That is a lot of time. And yes, it's not the dry political story, if you want to call political stories dry, but it had a lot of detail and it had a lot of, the little girl wasn't crying on camera. I didn't have any of that stuff going on. And they're willing to sort of, they're starting to see that perhaps that's the way to go and that perhaps people are going to make a difference, start noticing a little bit of a difference if we're going a little deeper. But I'll go to Randy.
Really quickly, I do think obviously the audience shares some responsibility. But let me, again, as frustrated as I am by the way it works, let me at least explain it from the television perspective. You have a newspaper in front of you, okay? You read the front page. If you read the first column, first of all, no story is entirely on the front page. They break it up. And all the, there may be 10 stories on the front page that you can glance at. So if you're not interested as a reader in the headline, one, you've already got the newspaper, and two, you could just turn your eyes that way. If you're not interested in the lead story on the 10 o'clock news or the 11 o'clock news or 6 o'clock news, and it goes more than a minute and a half, you'll turn the station, okay? And stations lose money. Again, the other thing is if newspapers have the luxury of being able to have long, in-depth stories and shift most of the bulk of the story to the back pages, the first five or six paragraphs may be on the front page. In television, you can't, after 30, 45 seconds, say, you know, in the middle of a sentence, say, for the rest of the story, go to B10. It doesn't work that way. So there are limitations, and I don't know the answer to it. But surely, if the audiences demanded longer, more in-depth stories, stations would respond.
I was wondering what your reaction was to Clint Eastwood at two time points, right after you saw it, and now 10 days or so later. My initial reaction was it was a disaster he's just really a mess. But I'm kind of wondering whether the line about you've got to let him go might hang in there for a while, especially if the Republicans use it in the commercials.
Well, I don't think Republicans will use it in the commercials because I think that that's a bad memory for them. But really quickly, I was on vacation the night he was speaking and didn't see it live and heard about what a disaster it was. And knowing I was coming here tonight, I just looked at it last night, and I thought it was awkward and stiff, and I thought it was a little bit embarrassing. But he didn't really say anything colossally idiotic. He just kind of stumbled around and went on forever, and conceptually it was a poor idea and went on too long. But I don't think he really said anything totally outrageous.
Again, it wasn't really about the content as much as it was about the performance, right? It was the same thing. It just he hadn't gone through the performance very well. I guess what was most startling was just you're so used to seeing those conventions and they're so scripted that I think the reason it captured all of us is because it was the one unscripted moment in the convention and it happened to be Clint Eastwood and it happened to be – it was unexpected what he did. Not only was it unscripted, but the way he did it was so unexpected. In some ways, at first, I was thinking, what were the Republicans thinking, letting this happen? And then on the other hand, there is sort of that concept of being refreshing that one thing wasn't scripted since everything is so planned out that it was such a relief to have something that wasn't perfectly planned out. I don't think it's going to be a big deal one way or the other in the end.
There are many people who are, you know, concerned and frustrated that the news and the media doesn't always give us the real truth. You know, there's alterations. How is this happening? Are they paid or forced or by vested interests? And I think this is definitely a situation. And do you see that changing for the better in any time soon?
So are you asking, are reporters paid or forced to report a certain way?
Well, I don't know exactly how to put it, but we're not always getting the real truth.
You know, I mean, certainly not in my experience, and I'm sure in Randy's, that there's ever been, as Randy pointed out, and I'm in the same boat, I've never been told how to tell a story, how to report it. I mean, I did a story on Toyota cars when I was at KTVU, and Toyota was the biggest advertiser at KTVU. And there was, you know, we had lawyers look at it to make sure everything was okay, but there was no concept ever that that story wasn't going to run, despite that being, you know, our main advertiser.
And I did stories on political candidates who pulled their ads from our station and cost us big time, and I was not told to change my stories.
Yeah, Toyota pulled all their ads for a quarter as well.
Now, I think that's one of the main things for everyone to understand about that. The rules of a game change over time, and it's not that there's, you know, like money changing hands and all that kind of stuff. There's pressure, and all the pressures come in over time. But anyway, we're at the end of another great event at the Commonwealth Club of California, and we want to thank Diane Dwyer and Randy Shandable for sharing with us.
Thank you.
That's a great inside look at what was really happening. And I would like to add one short story about Bill Clinton. Because in the 1992 New York primary, when he was running, and after he had his little mishap with Jennifer Flowers, I went to see him at a high school, and then the next day I was working in New York City. I went to work early, 6:30 in the morning. Those of you who know New York City, I was walking by the ice skating pond at Rockefeller Center, and I was walking down 47th to 6th. It's a very long block. And on 6th Avenue, Bill Clinton was walking up the street with five or six handlers. And I was the only one, because it's New York City, everyone starts late, I was the only one walking on that street. He stopped and waited until I got to 6th Avenue and then shook my hand and said, I hope that you're going to vote in the New York primary. And I thought, this guy's going to win. I mean. So, thank you very much. And so ends another event in the 110 years of history at the Commonwealth Club.